buy stuff. This is, unusual, unique in world history. In the old days, you didn't buy stuff. You didn't go to the store and buy stuff. What you did was the housewife, you bought cloth if you had the money, and the housewife would sew the clothing and stuff. And that was the idea of mass production for a consumer market is an industrial revolution concept, is the product of the free markets of the 18th and 19th centuries. So what you had is, just saying the growth of the standard of living doesn't really encompass that. It's the beginning of a real living standard. And with this, you have a tremendous progress in all areas, in civilization and economics and personal liberty, and technology, which goes along with it. And so the 19th century was the breaking through of this several century old movement of what we call classical liberalism. Of course, those days they didn't call it classical. We call it classical because it sort of died out, and we're trying to essentially restore it. And this liberal movement was rising, and everything was going great, and the liberals at the time were very optimistic, as well they should be. And then something happened. A glitch happened. Something happened on the way to Nirvana. And the something that happened was the growth of the development of socialism, which was a brand new idea in human history. And the socialist idea, which really sprouts in the 1830s and 1840s in Europe, was that we can still have this, because the previous opposition to classical liberalism, the opposition to freedom, was an opposition in defense of the old order. It was specifically anti-industrial, anti-mass consumption movement. The idea of keeping the lords and the dukes and the earls in their places in the state churches, and keeping their power and position. It was specifically and frankly an anti-general freedom movement and anti-industrial movement. Well, the socialists came along and said, look, we can do both things. We can have the same thing too. We can have higher standards of living. Matter of fact, we'll have better than liberalism or capitalism does it. We can have a high advancing standard of living. We can have freedom, and we can have everybody be happy and so forth and so on. We can do it through state control. We can have better ways through statism. And we order, or try to blend the two.
All right, well,
to one higher, allegedly higher.
Yeah, system. Wouldn't it be nice just sit around and listen to Murray Rothbard all dang day? But I'll tell you what that is in case you want to hear it later. It's great. It's called The Current State of World Affairs. It's Murray Rothbard at the Texas State Libertarian Conference. I don't know if that's the same thing as a convention or not. And it sounds like he's talking in 1989, 1990, 1991, somewhere right around there. I'm not sure. Did he say at the beginning that the Soviet Union was dead and gone, or just that it was falling apart? Great Murray Rothbard. In fact, hey, guess what? Murray Rothbard's biographer is going to be on the show today. Yeah, Justin Raimondo is the author of Enemy of the State, The Life of Murray N. Rothbard. And yeah, he's going to be on, not to talk about that, though. He'll be on about Ukraine. We are on the Liberty Express. There were some technical difficulties, but they've been ironed out. And so now on with the show, which means, in just a moment, commercials. Because it's that time. But don't worry, the rest of the show is going to be great. Murray Rothbard is already pretty good, you know. But what's going to happen is I'm going to talk about news for a segment, then I'm going to interview Justin Raimondo for a couple of segments, and then I'm going to complain about some other things for a little while, and then Alex B. Kane will be on the show, and I meant to Google it at my own site. I can't remember if I've ever interviewed him before. I think I have. Have I ever interviewed Alex B. Kane? Anyway, he's going to be on the show to talk about Syria, and so, hell yeah, man. I'm working on getting Mitchell Prothero on for tomorrow for McClatchy. But anyway. All right, hold tight. Be right back. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins. CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe, and tell them Scott sent you. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And, today, I tried to rotate him out. Today, I was watching Fox News all morning long. Goodness. It was great. I got to watch John Bolton say things. I love watching John Bolton say things. That guy's hilarious. One of the things that he was saying that was notable was about Afghanistan and what a betrayal it is that our feckless leader, Barack Hussein Obama, just won't do what it takes to get the deal signed to stay in Afghanistan. And, underlying this whole thing, which they won't really explicitly discuss, of course, is that the deal to invite, quote-unquote, America to stay longer, for America to stay longer, has to include immunity for American soldiers for any war crimes that they might commit. Right? The operative theory being, how the hell can you ask me to have my guys on the ground in Afghanistan without blanket immunity for any war crimes they're going to commit while they're there? Can't have that. Absolutely not. So, no immunity, no stay-e. And yet, at this point, I think, I don't know exactly how Karzai, is measuring these things. But apparently, I don't know. He may just be playing hard to get, but he's playing pretty damn hard to get. It seems as though he's decided that he would rather take his chances negotiating with the Taliban after America leaves. If he can follow the example of Nouri al-Maliki and just hang tough until the deadline expires, then that'll be it. And the Americans will have to go. All he has to do is just not give in the meantime. Difference, of course, is Karzai is representing the minority in terms of numbers and in terms of power on the ground if you subtract the NATO forces from the equation, the American forces. So that's quite a bit different than in Iraq, where America helped the Shiite factions win, and then the Shiite faction said, now get the hell out. Thanks a lot. Now beat it. And so Karzai is in, I don't think, as comfortable a position unless he switches sides. Which, why not? Could happen. But just so you know, whenever you see John Bolton or anybody else, and by the way, what he said was it was a mistake for the Obama administration and the Bush administration, he was being very fair, and the Bush administration before them to paint the Afghanistan mission as one of nation building. He says it should have never been about that. It should have been simply about we're protecting ourselves by killing anybody in that country that we decide, could be a danger to us, whatever. And if he just sold the mission as that, that's what the real mission is, and it's of the utmost importance, he says, etc. Except the threat from Afghanistan was never anything really worse than Bin Laden podcasting. It's not like Mohammed Atta learned how to hijack a plane in Afghanistan. What'd he do? Practice on their giant fleet of Boeing 757s? They took their flight school lessons here, mostly. Anyway, there's nothing magic about Afghanistan that makes it a great training ground or launch pad for attacks against the United States. Unless the United States is there in Afghanistan. Otherwise, it's the worst place in the world to be if you're trying to attack the United States. It's on the complete ass end of the planet Earth from here, from everywhere. The Durand Line? How the hell are you going to hit America from there? When they had to hire Egyptian graduate students going to school in Germany to hijack our planes to crash into our buildings. And according to the U.S. government, there ain't an Arab left in Afghanistan anyway. America chased them at least all into Pakistan, if not killed them all to death already, years ago. There is no threat from, as loosely as you might try to define it, Al-Qaeda, the friends of bin Laden and Zawahiri from a dozen years ago. They don't exist in Afghanistan. The mission is one of nation building. So all John Bolton really is saying is they should have stopped being honest. Their plan actually is to try to build up a government that can sustain itself there. At least, you know, on one level. I mean, maybe their plan is to prop up a government that never could sustain itself. That way they always have an excuse to stay forever, which is not really good for anything other than, you know, just making money if your job is, trucking oil from Pakistan to the troops on station or whatever. I don't know. If you're a job holder at the State Department or some NGO. Otherwise, it's certainly not in the interest of the people of Afghanistan, and there's no interest for the people of the United States there at all either. If anything, all they're doing is just creating more enemies. But I think, I didn't want to sell his argument short. That's what his point was. But my point is, ain't that something that the American army insists on immunity for war crimes, or they won't stay. Now, in Korea and Japan, the status of forces agreement is different. Our soldiers are subject to their criminal courts, at least in some circumstances. But in Afghanistan, we'll be damned if we let you savages try our guys for any crimes that they commit against your people in your phony, bogus courts. This is the government that we've propped up there. And of course, supposing all along that our guys are going to commit war crimes, the question is who's going to prosecute them or not when they do. And of course, they have committed war crimes. They're waging war against a civilian population that dares resist them. That's pretty much a war crime in the first place, stepping off the plane. But then you have real massacres and desecration of bodies and all kinds of things too. The kill team. That's different than a death squad. It's a kill team. Okay, if you call it a death squad, I guess that'd be all right too, right? I don't know. Maybe it would. But they say that Barack Obama called Karzai himself and said, "Hey, listen, you better give in to this." I guess I don't know if Karzai is even listening or he's busy shooting heroin into his arm. Huh? What? Oh yeah. That. Yeah, I'll do that. Puking on himself and accomplishing nothing for the Empire. He's secretly working for that Mullah Omar, I'm telling you. Is that Mullah Omar even alive anymore? I don't know. There you go. All right. By the way, quick note before we go out to break here. I got a couple minutes. About the drug wars. I told you before about how Radley Balco had answered. I forgot who wrote the first one. Hang on, I got my footnote in front of me. Don't let me get it all wrong. Oh, it was Gerson. I thought it was Michael Thiessen. Thiessen or whatever. It was Gerson, Michael Gerson, former Bush speechwriter, who had written a thing for the drug war. And Radley Balco completely just nuked him off the face of the planet with all of his statistics and, you know, truth and decency. And Michael Gerson's argument was completely obliterated. And then so this other guy, and he was very polite about it too. He was not like, oh yeah, look at me or anything. It was a scholarly sort of destruction. And then so this other guy, Lane, I guess is his name, has tried again and has tried to rebut Balco. And so now here's Balco again in the Washington Post today. Hang on a second. I got the tweet here somewhere, don't I? His newest one, Radley Balco, at the Post is, yes, the drug war really is pretty awful. A response to Charles Lane. And, man, so I put this out on Twitter, and I don't know Balco. For all I know, Balco don't like me or something. I don't know. I'd like to get him on the show. I invite him on the show. But I just went ahead and was rude and double dog dared all top conservatives on Twitter. Hashtag TCOT. I challenge all of y'all to fight with Radley Balco about the drug war. He'll completely destroy you. And then we'll be free at the end. There will be no conservative argument for the war on drugs left standing. None. Because they cannot withstand the awesome truth as funneled through the typing fingers of Radley Balco, who continues to completely destroy, to obliterate and disintegrate in ways that, you know, are typically against the laws of physics. Matter neither created nor destroyed. No, we're talking about really destroyed, not just transformed to pure vapor, but destroyed out of this universe. The arguments of these conservatives about how somehow our society is better off with a war on drugs. Madness. Nonsense. And Radley Balco is not a hardcore anarchist, individualist, purist libertarian. But boy, oh boy, he is like King Canute personally turning back the tide. Although I think Canute couldn't do that, right? But no, Balco is... He's like the ACLU and the Families Against Mandatory Minimums and the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws and the Stop Militarizing the Police Fund and Will Grigg and everybody against the police state in America combined. Now give this guy a suit of armor and a sword. He is rolling back the militarization of American law enforcement. Personally, he is changing. I mean, the fact that he writes for the Post, to me, is an indication that they had to let him write for them. They felt their credibility was at stake at this point, where there's so much journalism outside their mainstream that is doing the important work, that people are just turning away from them in droves. How in the world are they going to get anyone to read the Post? They have to bring Balco in. And then Balco comes in, just completely hydrogen bomb nuking them off the face of the planet. Thermonuke destruction of their pathetic conservative collectivist communist arguments for their social engineering project of prosecuting a war on drugs. And he just, I mean, and he doesn't even necessarily attack them as socialist, you know, utopians the way I would have either, but he just completely obliterates their arguments. So go and read Balco, damn it, at the Washington Post today and spread it around. Give it to your ministers. Give it to right-wingers in your life. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfey, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our first guest on the show today is Justin Raimondo. He's editorial director of antiwar.com and writes there three times a week at antiwar.com/Justin. It'll forward you on there anyway. Antiwar.com/Justin. He's also the author of Reclaiming the American Right, the Lost Legacy of the Conservative Movement, and Enemy of the State, the Life of Murray and Rothbard. Welcome back to the show, Justin. How you doing?
It's great to be back on my favorite radio show.
Oh, very nice of you to say there. Good to have you back here. So listen, your most recent piece at antiwar.com is called A World of Trouble, and you echo sentiments of Eric Margolies on the show last week, where he talks about how the current situation with America blundering around over there in Eastern Europe right now kind of reminds him of the setup to World War One, and seems like, at least to some eyes, to yours and his, where maybe the rest of the world, you know, it's completely passing them by,
You seem to think that the Obama administration is in the process of getting us into at least possibly a real crisis in terms of our relationship with the Russians right now. Is that about right?
Yeah, that's about right. What's happening is that, you know, these various powers are, you know, engaging in these alliances, and we have one with, you know, the government of Ukraine, or, you know, the now government, you know, it's very dangerous.
All right, so, well, let me ask you this. Why does America, or why does the American government have such an interest in Ukraine anyway? They're sitting on a bunch of oil or something?
Well, it's the, you know, it's the gateway to Central Asia. Pipelines have to go through Ukraine to reach Europe. So that's the prize. And but it's not just that. It's the Cold War, you know, the new Cold War that, you know, we're all seeing now, you know, like with the Olympics. You know, you couldn't have missed the huge propaganda anti-Russian campaign being waged in media. You know, Putin is Stalin. That's been going on for a couple of years, but now it's reached a climax of hysteria. And now it's the, oh, he's anti-gay and blah, blah, blah. You know, but they'll use any issue to really hit him over the head with.
Yeah, it's not like they really care. Obama's only been, you know, politically correct on the marriage issue for 2.5 years now or something like that. So he's not that far out ahead of Putin, I don't think.
Yeah, but it's very interesting. What's happening is that in this new Cold War, what you see is a complete role reversal. I mean, it used to be that the Russians were pushing this, you know, revolution now. You know, let's, you know, subvert all these governments. Let's overthrow all these governments which were supported by the U.S. And they had an international revolutionary movement that was dedicated to that. And now it's America that is sponsoring revolutionary movements all across the world. Of course, you know, the idea is to install governments that are, you know, like subordinate to a Washington. But I mean, it's interesting how you know, Russia is now the conservative force in world politics, and we are the revolutionaries.
All right, so that's, well, so talk about what's been going on in Ukraine since last November and the American role in it, as you understand it.
Well, we've been pouring millions of dollars into Ukraine's opposition movement ever since the Orange Revolution. We supported Yushchenko and his allies, and
back in 2004.
Yes, and it's pretty astonishing what's happening now. I mean, if you look at the character of the Ukrainian opposition, what you see is a motley collection of anti-Semites, neo-Nazis, and out-of-office oligarchs. These are the new freedom fighters.
All right, now, come on. Who are you, Morris Dees or something? You're telling me there's real Nazis involved over there?
Well, there actually are real Nazis over there, and they are involved. Let's look at some of these people. First of all, there's Svoboda, which is called the Freedom Party, but its actual name was originally the Social National Party. Get it? National Socialism, Social National. So, yeah, kind of a little wink-wink there. Their leader, whose name I'm going to try and pronounce, Ole Tianabok, was expelled from the parliament for denouncing the pro-Russian you know, party of regents, which is, you know, like Yanukovych's party, as a Jewish mafia, quote unquote. And so he was kicked out of parliament, but let back in, I guess. And what were they doing on New Year's Day? Well, you know, the opposition had a big rally at the Maidan, and they put on a little play, which was called the Zid. Now, what does Zid mean in Ukrainian? Well, I'm not going to even say it over the radio.
Yeah, I think everybody understands the context, yeah.
Right. I mean, it's an anti-Jewish epithet. And it was all about how Zid was a stereotypical Orthodox Jewish wheeler-dealer character. And he explained to the crowd that his various occupations included banking, stock market speculation, hosting a TV talk show, and loan sharking. And he sang a song in which one of the lines was, let's see if I can recall it, East and West belong to me, our people are everywhere, quote unquote. Now, the play goes on, and of course, the entire leadership of the opposition was sitting in the audience, and they were applauding this, including the people who are now in line to be president of Ukraine and prime minister. And they're now our favored candidates over there, and they were applauding this. And, you know, the play went on, you know, talking about the birth of Jesus and how Zid was collaborating with Herod. And then he decides to join the protesters, and he switches sides, joins the opposition, when he learns that on orders from the king, the Yanukovych forces are preparing to kill all Jewish firstborns. So, of course, the message here is that Jews only care about themselves. I mean, it's just like a neo-Nazi play. And there were tens of thousands of people sitting around celebrating this. How is this possible? That's what I want to know. I mean, why is no one in the media, which is very sensitive to any kind of ethnic slur, especially here in the West, why are we not hearing about this? I mean, how come I had to read it in the Jewish Telegraphic Agency report? And that's it.
Well, and not only that, I mean, there was an attack on a Jewish synagogue or something, and the head rabbi in Ukraine has now come out, and this may be an overreaction to some degree, but I don't know, at least it's newsworthy in and of itself that he said all Jews should get out of Ukraine right now while the getting is good.
Well, not only that, but he said that the Israeli embassy had told him to tell his people to stay inside. And if I were them, I would do that, or I would get out of the country.
Well, and there are many pictures of the mobs down in the Maidan Square there, with their proud Nazi lightning SS symbols, swastikas,
right,
and Iron Crosses, and Hitler salutes, and there's not much dispute about it, I don't think. Max Blumenthal did a great write-up for Alternet going through the evidence as well.
Right. You know, the symbol of the Svoboda Party is the old SS symbol. Their hero is Stepan Bandera, I think his name is, or Bander or something, who was the leader of the pro-Nazi, you know, fighting force in World War II that fought the Red Army. And significantly, I mean, you know, you have to look at how these forces are playing out. So people are estimating that about 30% of the people in the Maidan, you know, the hardcore activists, are actually neo-Nazis. So why are we supporting them? Why, I mean, why is U.S. taxpayer money being shipped to Ukraine?
Right. Yeah, Timoshenko, she might be a corporatist type of fascist, but not a... She doesn't necessarily have to have a brown shirt army, but we're going ahead and buying her one anyway, it looks like.
Well, I mean, she's an anti-communist. She's anti-Russian. So all these groups have one thing in common, and that is nationalism, or rather ultra-nationalism. So they hate the Russians. I mean, politics is about who do you hate? That, you know, that's the question. And there, it's the Russians. So they're all united in that. And, you know, I guess they'll fight over the spoils after, you know, they come to power. And they have come to power. So.
All right. Well, we have very little time here, but I wanted to bring up a Robert Perry piece on this subject where, you know, he sort of is acquitting his buddy Obama he loves so much or whatever. But he may have a point, I think, about the neocons themselves are really what they're doing here is they're trying to disrupt the Iran talks by driving a wedge between America and Russia under any excuse before this final nuclear deal can get done. What do you think about that?
Victoria, well, you mean the Syria talks?
Kagan, for example.
You don't mean the Iran talks.
Yeah, I mean, the Iran talks. That it's all about, you know, creating a difference between us and Russia before the final deal can be made over Iran, because that's all they care about is Likud.
Well, I mean, I don't quite agree with that. You know, I think it has much to do with, you know, Syria and this new, I mean, look, Putin.
Hold it right there. Syria, Iran, Ukraine. It's Justin Raimondo, antiwar.com/Justin. Coup in Kiev, and also, I forgot the latest one after that. Anyway, we'll be right back after this. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who provides his subscribers with a very real window into his investments, updating them on every move he makes in the markets. Right now, Mike's anticipating a bear and is dumping all the stocks while the getting is good, investing instead in gold and the commodities. Protect your assets and learn the wise ways of the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. And check out Mike Swanson's great contribution to the history of the rise of the American Empire and the war state. Available at ScottHorton.org/Amazon. Hey, I'll Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Justin Raimondo from antiwar.com, antiwar.com/Justin, about the coup in Kiev, America's recent regime change, with the help of some neo-Nazis in the state of Ukraine over there. And now, where we left off, I was asking you about Robert Perry's thesis that there may be a little bit of insubordination going on here with the wife of Robert Kagan, who's the Undersecretary of State for EU Affairs or whatever it is, you know, perhaps deliberately saying what she said about F the EU and all that controversy on an open line. I don't know if Perry makes that connection, but anyway, pushing so hard to make a controversy out of Ukraine in a way just to secure their more important interest, which is trying to sabotage the Iran talks by driving a wedge between America and Russia on the Security Council and the P5 plus one and all that. And then you were saying, well, I don't know, what about Syria? So what about Syria?
Well, I mean, you know, Syria is being brokered by Putin. He got Assad to, you know, give up the chem weapons. And so that alone, you know, he outflanked Obama on that score. So that alone is, you know, reason to, you know, like go after him. But, I mean, they don't need that reason because Putin has been an articulate spokesman, you know, against U.S. hegemonism. I mean, he alone has stood up to the U.S. and said, well, wait a minute, you know, all of this, you know, like invading countries. I mean, he has been very articulate, much more articulate than I am, on that subject.
Yeah, and, no, I wish they'd give him a regular spot in the New York Times. His most recent piece, and it was great, you know? replace Tom Friedman for all time.
Exactly. In fact, he should replace Tom Friedman.
That's what I'm thinking. No more.
I would actually read the New York Times then and actually subscribe to it. As it is, I can't because you know, they keep asking for money, and I say, well, no, it's not really worth it.
All right, now, so what are the Russians going to do about this? Because, well, the Americans won this time, right? The president had to flee.
Well, I don't think he's won. I mean, look, you have a bunch of different groups, roaming gangs of people, you know, dressed up in medieval armor, carrying clubs. I mean, that doesn't look like a very stable coalition to me. I give it maybe 10 more minutes until they start clubbing each other. So we'll see how that turns out. And, of course, secondly, there's the Crimea. There is eastern Ukraine. So what's going to happen with those people? They're not going to go along with this. And that's the very dangerous part of all this, because Putin apparently called Yanukovych and advised him to step down, which he did. Well, he didn't officially, but he flew the coup. So, I mean, it looks to me like Putin does not want a confrontation over this. And the stakes for Putin are really high, because if he loses, quote-unquote, Ukraine, there are much more nationalistic people in Russia waiting to take the reins from him. And if you think Putin is an autocrat, you haven't seen his right-wing opponents. So, if the West is saying now that Russia is fascist and authoritarian and a danger, wait until Putin loses Ukraine and then perhaps even loses office. Then we'll see what happens.
Who was it who coined the phrase about the Americans play checkers while the Russians are playing chess and all of that back in the Cold War? I believe they introduced him as the editor of Foreign Affairs on Jon Stewart. And he was basically giggling and saying, we got Putin nice and distracted with the Olympics and we're running off with Ukraine and all this. And he was saying it in such a way that, I mean, if I was on the Russians team, my assessment would be, like you said, give them 10 minutes. These guys are all going to defeat each other and we're going to win in the long term anyway. So they don't really need to react because, after all, it is their backyard, not ours. And the U.S. pulled off a coup d'etat in 2004 and what good did it do us? That lasted all of 10 minutes itself, right?
Well, I would remind people that Yanukovych won the last election, and he didn't steal it. He won fair and square. And I would also remind people of something they probably don't know, and that is that Russian is the first language of the overwhelming majority of people in Ukraine, including in Western Ukraine. So, and if you look at their websites, most of them are Russian language. Second comes English. Third is Ukrainian language. So, I mean, culture trumps everything. And
that's true. My wife is from there, and the way they think of it, and this is really kind of a sad and unfortunate legacy of Soviet communism, that the Ukrainian language was pretty much banished to the countryside, and everybody else just adopted Russian in order to get along in the communist system, and it is really pervasive. So it really is only the bumpkins now, basically, is the way they consider it, that still speak Ukrainian.
Right.
At least, you know, regularly.
Right. So, I mean, what's the meaning of that? Well, you know, the meaning of it is that Russia will win in the long run. But in the short run, we have the prospect of a civil war in Ukraine. And if the West tries to impose its government on the East, then you're going to see actual fighting. And then what will Putin do? Will he call in the troops? Well, certainly, you know, the neocons hope he will. But I think that what you'll see, I mean, look, there's one solution to this, and that is a plebiscite. Let the people of eastern Ukraine vote. Do you want to go with Russia? Do you want to go with, you know, the West? But, of course, they'll never allow that. So.
Well, and the problem here, as is often the case, is democracy itself, where a 51% majority gets to decide for the screaming 49 who can't stand it. And in this case, you know, when it comes to big decisions like leaning this far east or west, they're not willing to just wait for the next election and see if they can turn things around. And they go right out there and you know, riot and try to put a stop to it. So it seems like the solution is secession. But again, who's willing to, which side in power or which group in power on either side, east or west, would be willing to give up the other half of the country if they think they can control it too, you know?
Well, I think that what you're going to see is what happened in Georgia with Ossetia and Abkhazia. They had a plebiscite. They voted to go with Russia. The Georgians under Saakashvili said no way, and there was a war, which Georgia lost. So, I mean, I think you're going to, you know, see a repeat of that. And it's interesting that Obama, when he was running for president, when this occurred in Georgia, you know, competed with Hillary as to who could be the most anti-Russian. So I think you're going to see an extenuation of that worldview when that happens in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. Well, and he's been pretty soft, actually, on including Ukraine into NATO up until now, but it sure seems like that's what he's pushing for.
Well, I think that...
Or else, what does America care whether Ukraine's in the EU? It's all about us, and that means NATO, right?
Right, and I mean, you have to look at the money, okay? Ukraine is bankrupt, so it's in danger of default, which means Western banks that loaned it all these, you know, all this money is, you know, are in danger. And if Ukraine defaults, it could set up, you know, a kind of a, you know, dominoes falling, because these banks are inherently unstable anyway. And especially now. So that is the main concern, I think, of the EU. And that's why they were stepping kind of, you know, gently. And, you know, Nuland didn't like that. You know, she was, you know, saying F the EU because she thought that they were being too timid. Mm-hmm. But, of course, if the country collapses, then no one's going to get repaid, and all those European banks which had lent to Ukraine are, you know, stand to lose billions of dollars, which is not going to be good for them.
So the Americans are in more of a hurry than the European Union to put the American people on the hook for Ukraine's debt to the EU. Is that basically it?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's part of it. You know, money is always a consideration when you're talking about the American ruling elite and also its European counterpart. But I would bet that the American banks have less of a stake in Ukraine than the Europeans
right. do. But when the IMF bailout comes, that's just another term for the American taxpayer or inflation sufferer.
Right. I mean, since we are the major contributors to that particular scheme.
Right. All right. Well, I'm sorry we got to leave it there, but thanks very much for your time, Justin. Good to talk to you again.
Thank you.
All right, everybody. That's Justin Raimondo. He's editorial director of antiwar.com. That's antiwar.com/Justin. And he's got this piece, Coup in Kiev, and also A World of Trouble. Antiwar.com/Justin. We'll be right back after this.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support The Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Hey, guys. Welcome back. How's things? This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Thanks for tuning in. Alex B. Kane from Mondo Weiss and Alternet is coming up on the show. He does good writings, man. Oh, yeah. I was going to Google his name at my site and see if I've ever interviewed him before. Because, god dang, it's been more than 3,000 interviews now. And if I ever have interviewed him, it's only once or twice. But I can't expect my own brain to remember these things anymore. Not all the time. Not foolproof. Hey, I have interviewed him. Here you go. How Your Tax Dollars Fuel the Hatred of Muslims was the article I interviewed him about back in May of 2011, it says here. That sounds vaguely familiar. Islamophobes. Oh, training the cops on all this nonsense. Frank Gaffney-level propaganda about Muslims, what they're about and what they're going to do to you and all this crap. How Your Tax Dollars Fuel the Hatred of Muslims. I remember that. And it ain't just the hatred, right? It's the persecution. This is where the rubber meets the road. What the cops think. If you can call it that. You know, be generous. You can call it thinking on one level. They have to be conscious to decide to shoot all those steroids all day, right? So there's somebody in there. Anyway, so cool, yeah, same guy. He's going to be back on the show to talk about American intervention in Syria. And it's horrible. And I don't mean the article he wrote, I mean the intervention in Syria. It's like America's being run by madmen. Not just in a cruel way, but in a really stupid and cruel way. That's just my personal assessment, that the Americans are bad, the government. They're bad at being imperialists. I guess it depends on who you are in the game. Some people are doing pretty well off it, thank you very much, but not everybody else, yeah. Speaking of tax parasites, I know whenever I say tax parasite, you think, oh great, here he goes against Lockheed again. But no, this time it's the cops again. So, I was flipping through the internet earlier today, scanning the channels, looking for things to hate. And there was the police chief of Annapolis, Maryland, was caught believing in the stupid hoax. I'm sorry, I don't have a better word for it. I think that actually is the best word for it. It's a ridiculous hoax. It's not even a hoax. It's a headline in the Daily Current, which is like the Onion, only not funny. And the Daily Current headline was from the day after the implementation of pot legalization in Colorado that 37 people had died of a pot overdose. Well, that's funny because, yeah, there's nothing in pot that's toxic that can overdose you. The only way to die from pot is to get shot by a cop. Or I guess if you had a really big stack of bales of pot and it fell on you and then no one helped you get out. And you're stuck under there for a long time and had no food. And then you could starve to death. Although, no, I guess you could probably eat weed. I'd get you by for a while. No, I guess, yeah, only if you get shot by a cop. Because even if it falls on you, I mean, I guess it depends on how compact it is. Seems like the average man could block a falling bale with one arm above his head, you know? Now that I'm imagining the scenario. Anyway, so this police chief says, no, this is why we cannot legalize pot, medical pot, or any other kind of pot, not in the great state of Maryland. Don't you know 37 people died of pot overdoses on the first day of legalization in Colorado? Yeah. This guy is in charge of the life and liberty of other people. He's the police chief. He's the boss. He's the police chief in Annapolis, Maryland. Oh, boo-hoo, the 37 who died of a pot overdose, huh? And anyway, these are the people in charge of telling us what to do. And I just think it's great that they don't seem to know how horrible it looks when they talk about just how self-interested they are. You know?
hey, we can't have an end to the war on drugs. What about all that forfeiture money that we want to spend on ourselves? I mean, you got, go Google around, you can find these guys saying things along those lines. Very much acknowledging their conflict of interest and in complete denial about what a conflict of interest it is. They're openly bragging about, yeah, well, see, we exist to loot you. You belong to us, and our job is stealing from you under whatever pretext, and we like this pretext, this drug war pretext. Don't take this away from us. So, you know, police unions unite like Voltron and form the giant national police union lobby to do everything you can to keep every kind of drug illegal. Not because you know anything about drugs, not because you know anything about addiction or how to deal with addiction, not because you're even slightly aware of the economics of black markets and what is to be done to solve a problem like drug abuse, if one could ever hope to begin to solve it. No, just, hey, we're cops and we like making money being cops. So keep these ridiculous things illegal for no reason other than to keep us in the money of our victims. They'll come right out and tell you. Gotta have a drug war, so we have a job to do. Yeah, really. And then just like in the Balco thing today, oh, what about crack? Yeah, the drug war created crack. Oh, yeah, well, what about crank? The drug war created crank. If cocaine was legal and you could have just got it at Walgreens all along, you'd have never had an epidemic of either of those. I mean, obviously, some people would still do methamphetamine. Maybe some people would still smoke cocaine, but not for economic reasons. Not for, man, I can't find any cocaine reasons. And anyway, I just think it's funny that the chief of police really fell for that. He didn't have a single other group of neurons in his entire brain to tell him, that's not right, dude. 37 pot overdoses. What are you talking about, stupid clump of neurons that believe that stupid web story? That doesn't make any sense, does it? That couldn't possibly be true, could it? Stupid. Why don't you go out and kill somebody for jaywalking or something? Leave peaceful drug abusers alone. Ridiculous. All right. And then, there was something else about the clowns in charge I wanted to mention. Oh, the police. Man, I can't believe this story. And it, you know what? I don't know what to tell you. If your stomach can't take Glenn Beck, then find another place to read about or something. Glenn Beck interviewed the father of this girl. You may have heard of this story where the one set of doctors says she has this disease, mitochondrial something. I don't know if it's real or not or what. What am I, a doctor? No. But anyway, this one group of doctors says she has that. But then she got the flu real, real bad. So those doctors said, go to this other hospital. And at the other hospital, they said, she's not sick. She has a mental disorder. Some kind of Munchausen by proxy type scam where the parents are brainwashing her into believing that she's sick and in pain when really she's not, because that's ridiculous. And so then the hospital in Boston went to the government and the judges have repeatedly, for now a year, given the hospital authority, taken state custody of this kid and given her to her kidnappers at this hospital and refused any kind of outside expertise and outside opinions and whatever and any kind of semblance of justice or due process and put a gag order on the family and their lawyers from talking about it. And so here then the father had to go and violate his gag order and risk jail time for contempt or worse, whatever charges they could trump up for that, in order to try to get his story out. And the guy's no liar. Maybe he's some idiot who believes something that's not true, but I don't think so. But anyway, it's his mistake to make. And it is just absolutely incredible to me that anyone is getting away with a straight face that is claiming that this is legitimate. Where are the riots over this? What in the hell is going on here? Where are people who are running for state legislature, you know, a state assembly or whatever they call it in Massachusetts, solely on the platform of, I'm going to impeach this judge immediately. My first day in office, the impeachment begins against this judge. Yeah, make a giant political campaign issue about it. You know, with crowds of people with torches and pitchforks. Where are the riots over this kidnapping, this blatant kidnapping of this girl? There's 1,000 hospitals in this country. 10,000. Let these parents take her to whichever one they feel like. Let some other state government decide and put her in some hospital of their choice, for Christ's sake. But free her from these original abductors, at least. Here, they've separated her from her parents for a year, and her psychological condition doesn't seem to be getting any better. And this is crazy that this is even a debate. Who the hell are these people? Man, Massachusetts, remind me never to step foot in that communist hellhole. But you know what? Your state ain't any better, neither's mine when it comes down to it. There is no accountability for the people in power in this country. That's the truth of it. On March 7th at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., the Council for the National Interest is co-hosting the first ever national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Confirmed speakers include Walt Scheuer, Giraldi, McGovern, Katowski, Porter, McConnell, Weiss, Raimondo, USS Liberty survivor Ernie Gallo, as well as co-sponsors Alison Ware of If Americans Knew and the great Grant Smith of the Institute for Research Middle East Policy. That's the national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship, Friday, March the 7th, all day at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., natsummit.org.
All right, y'all. It's the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org is my website. I'm also at Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube / Scott Horton Show. Evan in the chat room says he's been buying stuff on Amazon all the time and using the link from my site. You know what? I think it's been working. I don't keep track of it all the time. It's been a few hundred bucks worth over the last, say, 3 months. So I think there are new purchases going through all the time. So I have no reason to believe that any of yours are being skipped. It must be you that's doing a hell of a lot of it. So, yeah, he says in the chat room here, Amazon doesn't really let him know, you know, verify to him that, yeah, he got that kickback you meant him to get or anything like that. I realize that. Have faith. I think it's working, Evan. And you know what? Even if it's not, I sure as hell appreciate you looking out and helping support the show. So thank you very much. But I think it is working. And I really encourage the lot of you, whenever you go buying, I saw somebody bought a range, you know, a stove and oven thing, you know, 2-in-1 stove oven. And it cost a few hundred bucks. And I got, you know, 20 bucks or 40 bucks or something off of that one. There's Amazon.com sells really all kinds of things. And I don't think they sell guns, but they sell a lot of gun accessories if you're a gun libertarian. They got a lot of what you need there anyway. And I don't think they sell cars. But other than that, pretty much anything you need, you can get from Amazon.com. And if you you don't even have to stop by ScottHorton.org, all you do is just bookmark ScottHorton.org/Amazon. Nice and simple. ScottHorton.org/Amazon. And that will forward you on to the correct thing. And then from the moment you land at Amazon.com after that, anything that you get, I'll get a small kickback from their end of the deal. Your price does not go up. This is not like a voluntary charity where I get a few pennies from your end of the thing each time you buy. This is you making Amazon pay me, is what it is, for stuff that presumably you're going to buy anyway. So there you go. Amazon.com, ScottHorton.org/Amazon. And thank you very much, Evan. I appreciate that. I appreciate that very much. Okay, so now, let me see. I got so many different things to complain about in so little time. Oh, yeah. I really should. We're going to be talking Syria with Alex Kane here in just a sec. So let me get to Africa here. From War is Boring, America is in Niger to help train commandos from 18 countries. Operation Flintlock exercises. Evidence of growing special ops war in Africa. And then that is accompanied by fancy technology makes you wait a second before they show you the headline. Okay. Rhode Island commandos quietly deploy all over the world. And this is a small National Guard detachment of Special Operations Forces. I guess I did not really realize the rankings there, where National Guard units are part of SOCOM and all of that. Why not? Anyway, if you want one-stop shopping on all this, read Nick Terse at Tom Dispatch.
about, you know, if you want the grand totals of where the special forces, the American special forces, are intervening in the world. It's everywhere. It's 120 countries that they'll admit to Nick Turse. And here they are again with the invasion of Africa. And, you know, it's a sloppy rhetorical trick because I'm not trying to trick you when I say that the Ethiopian army is just an adjunct, just a piece of the American army, that it's just a subunit of the U.S. Pentagon, of the American Empire. I know that you know that, no, there's a state of Ethiopia that maintains an army. And yeah, our guys, you know, fund them, trip them, equip them, train them. Sometimes I don't do words good. Equip them, train them, finance them, and order them around. Like, hey, invade Somalia now. Christmas 2006. And for one example, oh, and again, just the other day. Yeah, the beginning of this year, Ethiopia re-invading Somalia. When they do that, they're doing it at the behest of the American Empire. They basically are just proxy armies for the American Empire. So if their camouflage pattern is a little bit different and their skin tone looks way too black even for an American army force, which of course the U.S. Army really preys on the poor and minorities, tells them it's the only way out for them, you know, out of poverty for them in America, is to join up the service, brainwash everybody with that message from time we're kids, actually. If that military in the picture looks a little too black and their camouflage doesn't look quite right to be exactly American camouflage, don't worry. Yeah, no, they're still basically the U.S. Army. They're just a proxy. It's really a subjective matter of categorization on your part or mine. It's not a matter of fact anymore. They do what they're told by the American Empire. They kill who they're told to kill by the American Empire. So that makes them a proxy army of the American Empire. And now the mission is to do that same thing to every army in Africa. And there's what, 90 countries in Africa or 68 or some kind of thing? I forget now. There's a lot of countries in Africa. And so I don't know. As many of them as many SOCOM detachments as we need to turn them all into proxies for the American Empire. And then, you know, can have fun racing them or pitting them against each other, whatever we want. It's a pretty sad story. They call it the Africa pivot. It's the Army's pivot. Now, they're trying to be included in the Asia pivot as much as they can, but that's really more of a Air Force, Navy, Marines kind of operation over there in the East, right? What's the Army to do? Invade Africa. In fact, I saved these quotes right where I could get to them for you in case the issue came up and I could remember to bring them up. And I did. I remembered. Here they are. Here's two great quotes. This is the public choice theory of the American Empire. Are you ready? From the New York Times. With the United States military out of Iraq and pulling out of Afghanistan, the Army is looking for new missions around the world. Quote, as we reduce the rotational requirement to combat areas, we can use these forces to great effect in Africa, General David M. Rodriguez, the head of the Africa Command, told Congress this year. And from DefenseNews.com, based at Fort Riley, Kansas, the Dagger Brigade will be the first regionally aligned brigade the Army will field as part of a new initiative to keep non-deploying units engaged globally. Now that rotations to Iraq have ended, deployments to Afghanistan are winding down, and the service is looking for ways to stay globally engaged. Engaged globally, globally engaged. Looking for work, looking for a job killing people. Well, there's a gigantic, dark continent full of people who cannot possibly resist your violence. So, let's do it. Simple as that. Nobody's even saying, and actually they are saying this, but in these articles it doesn't even occur to them that, yeah, we got to keep China out. We have to make sure that if we ever have a war with China, we can prevent them from importing oil from these parts or anything like that. They just say, we're looking for war, killing people. Give us an army to train. Give us a group of rebels to squash or to hunt forever would be better even. And they're just so, come on. You know? Who wants to sit around doing nothing at Fort Bliss all day? Let's go kill people. That's what makes the grass grow is all their, you know, blood in the mud. There you go. Public choice theory of the American Empire. And I forgot who's my good footnote. I should have saved this footnote separately about how the army is all, you know, disgruntled over the Asia pivot because they don't get to take part that much. And so they're trying to make such a big deal out of Africa when everybody knows it's just a pathetic cry for attention and, you know, jobs for their generals. And by the way, this one about Niger at medium.com/war is boring. America in Niger to help train commandos from 18 countries. Of course, this is all about Nigeria and Mali and Libya and Somalia. All countries where, well, I guess the latter three of those are where America has created a crisis. And Nigeria, the first one there, that's where I guess it's sort of just a crisis of local backwoods Islamist right-wingers rebelling against the central government. There's a little bit of blowback there, I'm sure, going back. But the real point is the Americans are doing everything they can to internationalize the crisis now. And who knows? I don't know. I should do a better job and know just how many American special forces and CIA guys are running around, or some kind of approximate number running around in Nigeria already. But go look at Niger on the map. You see they've... and there's another story at War is Boring, actually, about this. I think it's at War is Boring. But if you look, you can find giant drone base in Niger. Not just some drone base. Massive new drone base for from now on being put in place in Niger. Well, you know, there's a guy with a rifle. Get him. He's a militant... Yeah, this from the Americans, right? Where we got one rifle for every American, 300 million, maybe more. Not that I'm against that. I'm a libertarian, but I'm just saying. Is that really our policy, that a man with a gun, that means, what, he sacrificed his right, not just to carry a gun, but even to live? And that, actually, more and more, that is policy in America, right? Just like the lady cop that shot the kid the other day who opened the door with a Nintendo Wii controller in his hand. Was that in Ohio? In Peoria, something like that. You know, as though if he had answered the door with a gun in his hand, then that made it okay to murder him, right? Not like he has a right to open the door to his own house with a gun in his hand or anything. We control her otherwise. Well, she was just terrified. She had no business being a cop, carrying a gun in the first place. Completely irresponsible and unaccountable. Just watch. He had a Wii. It's like Africa. Africa's got a rifle. Look out! Launch the Reaper drones. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our next guest on the show today is Alex Kane. He is Alternet's New York-based world editor and assistant editor for Phil Weiss's website, Mondo Weiss. You can follow him on Twitter at Alex B. Kane. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Alex?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm very happy to have you here. And I'm sorry, it's been quite a while since I interviewed you, 2 or 3 years anyway, and I had kind of forgotten whether I'd ever interviewed you before. And then, so I went back and Googled it on my own site, And I found where when I did Google you, at least one time before, I think it was just the one time, it was about these right-wing groups going around training the cops on these ridiculous anti-Muslim kind of protocols of the Elders of Islam, sort of conspiracy theories about what Muslims in their communities are up to and that kind of thing, which is a very important piece of work, and I was glad just to be reminded of it
when
I Googled
right.
your name. That's a very important subject, and I hope people read it. In fact, I think I still have it, the name of the darn thing in front of me here, if I can get my mouse to work. How Your Tax Dollars Fuel the Hatred of Muslims. Very good work. Everybody put that
Thank
in
you.
Your favorite brand of search engine. Okay, and now, so the one I wanted to talk to you about here today is four ways the U.S. is violently meddling in the Syrian civil war. That's at alternet.org. And you preface the four ways, first of all, with sort of a recounting about, well, what before I tell you the truth, let me give you a summary of the current completely ridiculous, or at least, you know, full of holes, half-truth kind of a narrative on TV news and coming out of the mouths of our senators about what exactly is going on over there and what needs to be done. So if you could start off with that, a little bit about, you know, what it is that they would have us believe before you set us straight.
Sure, sure. Well, you know, the Syrian civil war is an extremely brutal conflict. Nobody can deny that. And so, you know, as various former officials and current elected officials are watching the brutality spiral out of control, they, I think, understandably want to do something, although some of them, sort of more of the neoconservative wing of the Republican Party, they really want to depose Assad, not so much because they care about the Syrian people, but because they see it as, you know, a way to strike a blow at Iran, which is, of course, Syria's main ally. But in recent weeks, we've seen an uptick in calls for more American intervention. You know, this is something that, you know, John McCain, Senators John McCain and Lindsey Graham have been pushing for a very long time, almost since the civil war started in Syria in 2011. But we also have liberals and people on the left who also support American intervention in the Syrian civil war, which I think would be disastrous and would not force an end to what's a really catastrophic tragedy going on. So there's been an uptick in recent calls. Sandy Berger, a former Clinton national security advisor, said that, you know, now is the time to work with proxies in the region and to launch airstrikes to deter Assad from killing Syrian civilians. And in the New York Times, we had two very intelligent academics, Danny Postel and Nader Hashemi, co-editors of the book called The Syria Dilemma. They argue that the same thing, you know, it's time for more American intervention and air cover to stop Assad and some rebel groups from using hunger as a weapon of war. So that's kind of the spark for this article, all those calls for intervention.
Mm-hmm. And as you say here, they seem to always say, and for years on end now, they seem to, they never really say this. It's always sort of the unstated assumption of the argument is that America has not been intervening in any sense this whole time. America's only sat back and done nothing. When, of course, Obama has outright called for the dictator to step down. And, you know, basically, at the time, that was widely interpreted as instructions to the rebellions that don't give up no matter what. You know, we got your back eventually here. So keep fighting. And you know, they've been, you could say they've been trying to wage peace in Geneva, but it seems more like they're just trying to give cover to the rebellion to keep it going on. In fact, they've admitted in a few places, right, that Israelis and Americans, that the best policy they see here is to let the Baathists and the jihadists continue to fight it out as long as possible, sort of Andrew Sullivan's old flypaper thesis for Iraq. And just, you know, let the two sides fight it out. Don't help the rebels so much they win. But certainly they have been helping the rebels all along, right? For 2.5, 3 years now.
That is an interesting point. I think there are splits within both the Israeli government and U.S. government as to what to do about Syria. But certainly a prevailing sentiment among many folks in both governments is that, you know, this is not, we don't want to tip the balance of the battlefield too far. You know, we have Hezbollah on one side, an ally, you know, Hezbollah, the Lebanese militia that is now fighting in Syria because Assad has been a close ally of that group and has allowed them to stockpile weapons in Lebanon. And then on the other side, you have both the Free Syrian Army, but also more radical jihadist rebel groups, some of them quite brutal, and there's been infighting between these rebel groups over the harsh rule that some of the Islamic fundamentalists involved have imposed on areas of Syria that they control. So, you know, what is happening right now is that it's essentially a stalemate, although Assad in recent months has gained the upper hand in Syria. But, you know, the carnage continues. Nobody's going to win in the short term. It's unclear what will happen in the long term, and the carnage continues to mount, and Syria continues to splinter with really catastrophic effects for the people of Syria. So you're right. And, of course, the U.S. has been intervening for many months now, over a year now. You know, they've been arming the rebels. They've been training the rebels. You have sanctions on Assad and so on. So, but, you know, I don't want to give the impression that the Americans are bent on overthrowing Assad at the moment. Yes, the rebel groups that we're arming are bent on overthrowing Assad, but you know if that was a policy goal of the U.S., then we would be doing much more than we are doing. You know, it's kind of a complicated situation, but you have the U.S. intervening in these ways, but also the intervention is not enough to tip the balance in any way.
Right. Well, I mean, it's interesting, you know, the enmity against the Assad regime goes way back, and the strategy for regime change there goes way back. But Hillary Clinton, when she was still the Secretary of State, I believe, I guess it was a year after this really all broke out. It would have been in the spring of 2012. She told CBS News that under, you know, kind of pressure, under the question, why aren't you doing more to help the rebels? Come on, because it's the dictatorship versus the people. Everybody knows that. That was certainly the more simple narrative then. It's kind of become more complicated now, finally. But she answered that, well, you know, actually, I'm an al-Zawahiri, and the leadership of Hamas have endorsed the rebellion there. So, and we don't really know who any good guys might be to arm over there, and so we don't really want to help Zawahiri, right? We've got to tread very carefully here. And of course, the history says, according to, I believe, leaks from her camp to the New York Times and others, that she then went on to push for more and more intervention there, along with Panetta and Petraeus, that Obama actually refused to take their bad advice and support the rebels even more. But she seemed to be, I mean, this has to be a conversation taking place in the Oval Office, right? Is that as much as we hate Assad, the other guys are the suicide bombers from the last war. And we're not really, you don't really want to be the president who helped them outright win a war against the government in Damascus, do you, Mr. Obama? Right? I mean, so no wonder that they backed down after it wasn't so easy in the first place. And now they seem to have settled for more of this stalemate, right?
Right. I mean, that is the fear. I think it's a legitimate fear to have. You know, say, you know, when Obama threatened to bomb Syria back in August, when Assad used chemical weapons, and I think it's clear that Assad did use chemical weapons. I think Human Rights Watch conclusively determined that. I don't buy any. I think conspiracy theories that the rebels did it themselves. I don't buy that. But when Obama was threatening that, you know, people were saying, look, this intervention may get America drawn further into the Syrian civil war, will, you know, fuel the desire to overthrow Assad and tip the balance to the rebels. But then what happens? Say Assad's government is overthrown. Is the civil war over? Many people say probably not. There would be more violent power struggles within the rebel groups because you have more Western allied groups like the Free Syrian Army, which is a loosely organized sort of coalition of rebel groups that have got the backing of the West. Then you also have groups like Jabhat al-Nusra, which is an al-Qaeda affiliate. They've declared their allegiance to al-Qaeda, and they're actually the most effective fighting force on the ground in Syria. And then you have even the more extreme group, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, which is a transnational jihadist group that has actually broken off from al-Qaeda because and Jabhat al-Nusra because they don't think al-Qaeda is extreme enough. So you really have a messy situation on the ground, and you know, I don't know what the solution is, but you know, if you overthrow the Assad government, if you intervene forcefully, would that spark more violent power struggles within Syria? And you already see violence within the rebel groups. You have, over the past couple months, the Islamists fighting the Islamic fundamentalists. And so you have already this infighting.
Well, really bad. It was Zawahiri's messenger was suicide bombed by the ISIS guys just day before yesterday or something. All these ultimatums. Seems like a really big fight among al-Qaeda's over there. And by the way, let me ask you this. Oh, geez. You know what? I don't have enough time to ask you this. We're about to have to go out to this break. When we get back, I want to ask you a little bit more about the Free Syrian Army and the Islamic Front and things like that, so much as you know. And I actually, I think we're going to start, though, again with the chemical weapons thing there, because I don't want to get too far into it, but there's something to be said. It's Alex Kane from Alternet and from Mondo Weiss. We'll be right back after this, y'all. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. We're talking about civil war. No, not in Ukraine. That's next week. Syria, the one that's been raging here. I just want to say real quick, Alex, regardless of what anybody's opinion is about exactly what happened with that chemical weapons attack, I don't think it's quite right to reduce dissent from the Human Rights Watch report to being just merely conspiracy theories. After all, the CIA analysts refused to sign off on the official report, and that was why they had to put out a government report instead of an intelligence report about what happened there. And the New York Times even had to admit that there was no 9 kilometers here. At best, these rockets could have gone 3, etc. And Seymour Hersh and others have disputed the concreteness of the conclusion, etc. So it's not quite, 9/11 truthery to think that Human Rights Watch and the Obama administration were going off a bit half-cocked there on that one, correct? No?
No, you're right about that. I mean, I certainly don't want to cast any questioning of the official narrative about chemical weapons as automatically a conspiracy theory. Forgive me if I was a bit too sweeping in that. The reason why I said that is because I do think that there are some conspiracy theorists out there that believe that the rebels did this all themselves, and that they did it to spark an American intervention, and that they concocted it, and they killed 1,400 of their own, and the civilians, you know, civilians in the suburb of Damascus that had happened, you know. So, but on the other hand, yes, you know, Cy Hirsch, quite a venerable investigative journalist, and others have cast doubt on the narrative. Although, you know, on the other hand, I don't think casting doubt on the Obama administration's narrative necessarily leads to the conclusion that the actual story about the chemical weapons attack and who perpetrated it was totally wrong. You know, I think that enough evidence has emerged that points to the Assad government as carrying out the attack.
That's fair enough. And you may very well be right that people who are leaping to opposite conclusions, you know, are baseless in doing so. But certainly I don't think it was that simple, because, you know, I was talking to a lot of people, including former CIA officers and whoever, saying that it just still was not altogether clear exactly what happened there. Anybody who was going off any level of cocked about what happened there was going off half cocked, because nobody really knew about what had happened. It was all about, you know, going back and looking at circumstantial evidence and trying to figure out, you know, the crime scene after the fact and all of that. So nobody watched it happen in real time or recorded it in real time. All right. Anyway, so I didn't want to get too far off onto that, but it seemed like an important point. And especially when it's the kind of thing that they're invoking as a casus belli, and they're just saying, hey, listen, trust us, it's beyond a reasonable doubt. Not that we have the case beyond a reasonable doubt for you here today, but we are satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt, and that's all you need to know, which was what our Secretary of State was claiming at the time. And you know, when if there's any doubt whatsoever, we need to go real slow about things like that. I'm sure we're agreed.
Yes, absolutely.
All right. So now, anyway, let me ask you about this. And just because I don't really understand, it seemed to me like right around the turn of the new year, the Free Syrian Army pretty much ceased to exist, and Idris has been banished now, the former leader. And as far as I could tell, those guys weren't really doing much of the fighting anyway. It always was al-Nusra and then ISIS that were doing most of the fighting. But then there's this new group that they call the Islamic Front. And it seemed to me like, well, I was wondering, is that what they're trying to rename al-Nusra and say, well, these are now good al-Qaeda versus ISIS, bad al-Qaeda, or good meaning the ones more loyal to Zawahiri for some reason? Or is it that they're trying to reconstitute the Free Syrian Army of, you know, CIA expats and Jordanian trainees and whatever that they're trying to put in there, the minimal force from before with a new name? Or do you know? Does anyone know?
Well, you know, those are all good questions, and you know, I'm looking at this from the U.S. You know, I have not been on the ground in Syria, and you know, even the journalists that have been on the ground in Syria, you know, they're courageous and they're doing a great job, but the battlefield shifts so fast that it's really tough to get a great sense of what's, you know, going on. Now there's a significant difference between the Islamic Front and the Free Syrian Army. There's been upheaval within the leadership of the Free Syrian Army. The leadership, at least the Western backed leadership, is sort of operating in Turkey and Jordan, and under the banner of the Syrian Military Council, and they have ties to the Free Syrian Army, which I believe is doing fighting on the ground in Syria as well. But your question about the Islamic Front points to the sort of incredibly complex and disparate nature of the Syrian opposition. So the Islamic Front, you know, they're Islamist fighters in Syria, and you know, they are sort of backed by Saudi Arabia. At the same time, they're not al-Qaeda, and they're not affiliated with Jabhat al-Nusra or Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. So, you know, they're just another sort of Islamist coalition on the ground in Syria that has actually been fighting with the al-Qaeda and the more extreme groups on the ground in Syria, they're the front that has attacked the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. So all those questions point to just the sort of mind-boggling and complex nature of the Syrian opposition.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm working on trying to get Mitchell Prothero from McClatchy newspaper newspapers back on the show. David Enders, thankfully, is on vacation from the war zone for now, at least. But, you know, when I talked with him, I asked him about this, and he was saying that one thing that he could assure me was the only differences in the leadership between the al-Nusra Front and ISIS, and for that matter, even, I think he was saying, even the Free Syrian Army then, was who's who and who takes orders from who. None of it was ideological. All of them are basically what we would call hardcore bin Ladenite Sunni Islamist radicals. You know, they're not even, you know, the conservative old men of the former Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood. These guys are bin Ladenites. They're the prisoner beheader, suicide bomber, berserkers, basically. And so who to side with, you know? If they really wanted a peace deal, who do they bring to Geneva to represent these guys?
Right, right. Well, the fighters at the West is certainly backing the Free Syrian Army, and they and sort of those fighters affiliated with them, and sort of the political forces more affiliated with the FSA were brought to Geneva. But then that question becomes: well, how much control do they have on the actual battlefield? And I think that's a really interesting question.
Now. So talk to us a little bit, and I'm sorry that it gets such short shrift. It shouldn't at all, regardless of who all is responsible for it in any degree, the American government, the one I'm presumably somewhat responsible for or not. I want to know as much as you can tell us about the humanitarian situation there. Of course, there are camps of Iraqis and Palestinian refugees from their wars in Syria. I mean, what about them? What about all the refugees and all the dead?
Well, it's just simply awful, you know, and you know, I think the bulk of the blame has to fall on the Assad government. You know, as much as I'm against forceful American intervention, I also recognize that the Assad government is doing some heinous things on the ground. That's not to say that there are Islamic fundamentalist groups that have also done heinous things. They just don't control enough territory to impose their actions throughout the country. Assad has that power. You know, he has used helicopters and jets to kill civilians. And I think this is none of this is really in doubt. You know, Syrian government seizures have led to starvation. You know, the government has supplies in, and that's actually part of what the Geneva.
I'm sorry, there, Alex. Your audio cut out just that last sentence there.
The Syrian government has cut off parts of cities from aid and from food supplies,
mm-hmm.
And so you know, starvation and hunger have become a weapon of war, and in some cases. The rebels have also done this, but on a much larger scale, the Assad government has done this, according to sort of respected, incredible sources. You know, in Yarmouk, this gets to your question about Palestinian refugees in Syria. Of course, the Palestinian refugees in Syria are there because they were expelled in 1948, or they're the descendants of those who were expelled in 1948 during what Palestinians call al-Nakba, the catastrophe, which is Israel's founding, which, of course, led to the expulsion of some 750,000 Palestinians. You know, hundreds of thousands of them went to Syria. Many of them, about 150,000 of them, have gone to this place, a suburb of Damascus called Yarmouk, and there's a Yarmouk refugee camp in Yarmouk, and Palestinians live there, right? Now, so the Palestinians were expelled from historic Palestine, and now they are caught in the middle of the Syrian civil war, and the refugee camp and the actual whole suburb has been under siege during the war, and you know, and malnutrition has become a real big problem. People, actually, an imam in Damascus has allowed the folks caught in this to eat cats and dogs. This is how bad.
I'm sorry, we got to stop there, Alex. We are all out of time. It's Alex Kane, everybody, from Alternet. Thank you very much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
He's also at Mondo Weiss. Four ways the U.S. is violently meddling in the Syrian civil war is at Alternet. See you tomorrow.